It's time to head out on the front porch on KFRM. Grab your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation on the front porch.
Hi, this is Kyle Bauer. I get a chance to visit with Michael Brown today. He's Global Director of Counter-Narcotics Technology at Rigaku Analytical Devices, but he's a former senior DEA special agent. He has a perspective on the war on drugs and the drug issues that I have never had access to before. I think we'll have a great time visiting with Michael. Michael, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
What is your background? I assume it's through law enforcement prior to DEA, and how long were you in DEA?
Well, I graduated from the University of Cincinnati with a degree in urban planning with good intentions to go to law school, but I had an opportunity to join DEA in 1989, and 32 years later, never looked back.
Wow, you were there a long time then. So is there certain jobs that you had at DEA, or kind of explain to me how DEA works?
Well, DEA has a number of various positions. You know, I started out, everybody's a special agent. I started out in Detroit where I did 10 years. Prior to that, I had an opportunity to go to the U.S. Army Ranger School and work with DEA Special Operation Groups in Central and South America where we really had boots on the ground. That was an actual war on drugs. That was very successful. So I did that for 4 years. And then I spent the next 25 years working overseas in drug production countries, transit countries such as Pakistan, Afghanistan, Myanmar. I did some time in Uzbekistan and in Central Asia.
Well, I mean, truly, you were boots on the ground, war on drugs. You know, does the United States, are we the country that has the biggest, I'll say, problem with drugs, or is that drug problem spread all across the world?
Now, I would say the United States has the largest substance abuse problem in the world right now.
Well, I mean, that's the news we get, but is it because the other countries are tougher, or do we have the money to buy it, or do we have a cultural issue, or why is it that we have such a big problem?
Well, if you look at the world and you split it up into sections, first, let's look at Southeast Asia, you know, Japan, South Korea, you know, Thailand. These cultures have a very strict anti-drug cultural mentality, right? There's no drug use, it's acceptable, it's forbidden, and it's in the families, it's in the religion, it's in the government. If you go to Europe, Europe has a more progressive policy which accepts drug use, and then they try and manage it. If you go to Central and South America, third world countries, where narcotics are produced, they generally don't have a big substance use problem. But when you come to America, the most industrial, successful country in the world, we seem to have a lot of social mental issues, and that seems to be increasing as each year goes by. And that is a very significant social issue which we have to address, because that's driving the rapid substance addiction issues that we have.
See, I'm 66 years old, and the war on drugs has been going on my entire life. It appeared to me, just from my perspective, that the drug that we are fighting against changes about every decade. I mean, in other words, it was marijuana at one point, then it was heroin and LSD in the 60s, and now it seems to be fentanyl. Is my perspective right, or is it just what happens to draw the news of the year?
It's right to some degree, but let's break down the war on drugs. We hear that all the time. What does that actually mean? Well, the war on drugs is really, it's a two-part series. The first war on drugs is one that's domestic, right? That's DEA, HSI, local and state law enforcement, going after drug dealers and drug distributors. And I think we do the best job in the world at that. U.S. law enforcement, by far, is number one in the world. But where we run into a problem is that international drug war, right? Where are drugs produced? Not in Chicago, not in Philadelphia, not in New York. They're produced in Central and South America, and in some parts of Europe. Precursor chemicals come from China and to some degree India. DEA authority ends at the U.S. border. We do not have the ability, or U.S. law enforcement does not have the ability to reach across those borders and to affect mitigation efforts. that's where we have to rely on the bilateral relationship, meaning we have to rely on our foreign host country partners if we're going to have a successful counter-drug strategy. In terms of narco evolution, you mentioned marijuana in the 60s to fentanyl now. Well, the cartels are very astute at monitoring addiction patterns. They look at what's being used, and their job is to continually evolve to the next narcotic, that substance that is more addictive and more potent than the last, because greater addiction means greater profit. And let's understand why the cartels are in business. It's to make money, pure and simple. If you make a better product, you're going to make more money.
So have the players in the cartel evolved? I don't just mean personalities, but we always hear about the drug cartels in Mexico. Are those cartels spread across the world, or is it just the Mexican cartels that spread across the world?
Well, you have a global criminal networks, right? You have drug cartels in Myanmar. You have cartels in China, in Japan. You have the Yakuza. You have the outlaw motorcycle groups, such as Hell's Angels, all over the world. You have Bosnians. You have Russians, Central Asians. But the most successful drug cartels in the world are those in Mexico and those in Central and South America. And they have networked globally with all the other drug trafficking groups, being the primary, what I call, source of supply. Cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine primarily are supplied by your Central and South American cartels. To some extent, your cartels in Myanmar supply methamphetamine to Australia. In Afghanistan, you have the Taliban and drug trafficking groups supplying heroin and methamphetamine to Central Asia and Western Europe.
And are groups like the Taliban, are they doing it purely for profit? I mean, it's a means, if you will, of making income so then they can do their political gains?
Well, DEA showed very clearly in the 1990s and to present that the Taliban was actively involved with drug trafficking organizations in that country to produce heroin and methamphetamine. And, of course, Taliban is a terrorist organization. Any money made from the drug production goes into drug production and, of course, terrorist activities. And it's the same with Hezbollah. Hezbollah has been involved in cocaine trafficking for the last 15 to 20 years, and now they're involved in Captagon, which is a very powerful stimulant made in Lebanon and then shipped to the Middle East. So we have a history of seeing not only drug trafficking groups, but also what I call narco-terrorists involved in drug trafficking to further their terrorist activities.
Well, you talk about narco-terrorists. I mean, have the Mexican cartels been so successful because of their methods? Or are they really smart, or is it because they're just ruthless? Why have they been, I mean, it's been decades now that it may have evolved who is a cartel, but the cartels have been strong for decades.
Well, cartels have been strong for decades, but they've become much stronger now. Most would agree that Mexico is a failed state, really run by the cartels as a shadow government. If you look at the violence in Mexico, it's equivalent to what we saw with Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, there are beheadings, there are mass murders, there are kidnappings, there are rapes. The narco-trafficking groups have evolved, in my opinion, to the level of narco-terrorist groups that are basically terrorizing the entire state of Mexico as well as Central and South America. You have groups like the FARC or the Medellin cartel under Pablo Escobar, which blew up an airliner and killed 300 people. So we've seen an escalation in violence by drug cartels in countries which don't have the capability to implement successful mitigation strategies and then become basically students or subjects of the cartels.
Let's just stay with Mexico. It seems to me, though, that for literally centuries, the Mexican government has been wrought with corruption. And it's just in the culture of the people that, like, when they vote, they just vote for the person who is going to be maybe the least criminal to them. The citizens of Mexico expect their elected officials to be corrupt. Am I fair in saying that or not?
Well, if you look at the history of Mexico, they never had a revolution like we had in the United States, where we pushed out the British and instituted a successful democracy. Mexico was always ruled by elite Spanish, right? The Spaniards came in, dominated the Indian population, and established a judicial legal system, which has always been one of the elite. Mexico's government, in my opinion, has always been an oligarchy that's controlled the lower class peasantry. And I think that's still the same today. You don't see peasantry evolving into elite status, political positions in Mexico. So that created an opportunity for the cartels to simply spread enough money around to control the elite and to create a narco state. I mean, if you look at President Obrador, he's done very little against the cartels to degrade their capabilities of, one, acquiring the essential precursor chemicals, and two, producing billions of pills of fentanyl and multi-ton quantities of methamphetamine and heroin.
That is Michael Brown. He is the Global Director of Counter-Narcotics Technology at Ragaku Analytical Devices, and he was a DEA agent for several decades. Join us more after the break when we talk more about the war on drugs. Welcome back to On the Front Porch. My guest today is Michael Brown. He is a former senior DEA special agent, but he is currently the global director of counter-narcotics technology for Ragaku Analytical Devices. Michael, tell us about Ragaku and what their analytical devices do.
Well, Ragaku is a company that produces a Raman spectroscopy device, which is a fancy word for a handheld laser that can be used to identify unknown substances such as narcotics or precursors. And when I was a DEA country attaché in Myanmar from 2017 to 2019, I worked with the Myanmar police in degrading the precursor chemical supply chain for methamphetamine that originated in China and came across the border and was used to make methamphetamine. I played a critical role in developing a technology strategy using handheld lasers produced by Ragaku to identify mislabeled chemicals coming across the border. Within the first 6 months of a program that we initiated, we seized over 6 tons of precursors that were mislabeled that would have been used to make multi-ton quantities of methamphetamine. So after I retired 3 years ago, Ragaku asked me to come on and be the director of counter-narcotics technology and assist them in developing counter-drug strategies that utilize Raman spectroscopy in mitigating counter-drug strategies.
So are these portable devices you carry, or is it a portable lab? How does that work?
It is a large-sized lab condensed into the size of a small handheld portable device that a police officer, a fireman, a school resource officer could use in the event of an unknown substance found in a building. The nice thing about this technology is you don't have to open the packaging. Long as the laser can read through or penetrate clear plastic or color plastic, you can get a very accurate, what we call, presumptive analysis of what that substance is. So this alleviates the risk to, say, a police officer exposing himself to fentanyl, which could, as you know, create an overdose relating in a fatality.
Well, that's very cool. Well, okay, before we went to the break, we were talking about Mexican government and, you know, over the years, how the government is a puppet to the cartels. Let's come to our side of the border a bit. Over your years of experience with DEA, did you notice a difference on who was president in the United States as to what the war on drugs looked like from your side as a DEA agent?
Well, I had the opportunity to work under the Bush administration 1 and 2 and under the Trump administration, and I would have to say that their drug policies were much more in line with mitigating the effects of the cartels. I would also say under Obama, the foreign policies with counter-drug and counter-terrorism were also significantly strong. But I would definitely say under the Trump administration, DEA, we did very well in our international arena dealing with various countries at the bilateral level.
So the drugs that are coming across the border now from Mexico, I'll just stick with Mexico. Is that fair to say the lion's share of the drugs come from Mexico, or am I wrong?
You know, America's main source of narcotics are the Mexican cartels, period.
Okay, so currently, is it fentanyl? That's all I hear about is fentanyl these days. Are there is that mostly of what's coming across?
Now, fentanyl is the new kid on the block. We still have significant amounts of heroin coming across the border, and more recently, methamphetamine use has surged. And, you know, people don't talk about it, but there are a lot of overdoses related to methamphetamine causing fatalities. Of course, fentanyl is the most powerful substance that the trafficking groups are making and selling. And, of course, it's more potent than heroin and fentanyl, and it's more deadly. Less than 2 milligrams can kill an adult male within 15 to 30 seconds.
You know, I'd read headlines somewhat recently that there's enough fentanyl in the United States to kill basically everyone in the country. That seems hard to believe. And you would think if that was the case, fentanyl would be so cheap that there would be no market for it.
Yeah, I think the numbers are a bit exaggerated. If the police sees, you know, 1 million fentanyl tablets and 2 million hit the street, we're not seeing 2 million overdose fatalities, right? The DEA estimates that about 7 out of 8 pills have enough fentanyl in it to kill an adult male. Well, of course, that depends on a lot of factors. Is it a longtime drug user who understands that he has to cut that fentanyl down with an adulterant to make it safer? Or are we talking about a 16-year-old who takes an Adderall and it turns out to be fentanyl with a gram and a half and they die? Right, so it's really, it's what we call a squid game. It's a percentage game. If you happen to get that wrong pill, there's a very high probability that you're going to die.
Okay, I'm embarrassed about this, but for the most part, my understanding of the drug cartels is from watching Breaking Bad on, what was it, Netflix. Now, I purposely tell you that so you realize how naive I am on this, but do they make most of the drugs in Mexico, or is that just where they ship them to ship into the United States?
Well, I wouldn't say that's a question. Breaking Bad, what we see now is life imitating art. When Breaking Bad came out, you would think that was fantasy. Now I can tell you that's 100% real. What we see in Mexico or the cartels working with PhD chemists, individuals who understand precursor chemicals, and what they are doing is they are ordering those precursor chemicals primarily from China. Once those chemicals get to Mexico, they are broken up and sent to hundreds, if not thousands, of clandestine fentanyl labs spread out across Mexico, where the fentanyl pills and fentanyl powder are produced and then smuggled into the United States for distribution.
Well, if there's hundreds or thousands of labs, then that's a very, very big job. It's probably easier to try to stop the flow of the precursor chemicals, I'm asking.
Well, you have to understand there are 5 critical capabilities that the cartels need to be successful. Can I take a minute to go into those?
Sure, absolutely. Please do.
So the first critical capability is they have to be able to procure and purchase those precursor chemicals, right? That means money flow back and forth. The second critical capability, and we're talking about fentanyl, is they have to coordinate the transshipment of those chemicals, generally air parcel express or air cargo, from China to Mexico. The third critical capability is then they have to collect those chemicals and turn them into a finished product. That's fentanyl pills or kilograms of powder. And the fourth critical capability is they have to smuggle them across the border. And the fifth and perhaps most critical capability, they have to collect the money from distribution and have it laundered through Chinese criminal groups and sent back to Mexico. Now, to effectively degrade the cartel capabilities, you have to affect at least 2 of those critical capabilities. And the 2 that we can affect without going outside the United States is 1, cross-border smuggling, and 2, money laundering capability. Those are the 2 areas where we can effectively degrade that supply chain and perhaps make it harder for fentanyl to come into the United States.
So it probably depends on what your diplomatic capabilities are with the countries who are supplying the Mexican cartels.
Well, in terms of diplomatic relationships, in my opinion, that's not going to get us anywhere. We've been working with China since 2012 on degrading fentanyl companies from sending those chemicals. That has resulted basically in very little success in my experience and opinion. And, of course, the bilateral relationship with Mexico in terms of actually degrading cartel capabilities has been unsuccessful. So, really, we're going to have to save ourselves, and that means reinventing and redesigning cross-border strategies that will degrade the number of vehicles coming into the country, because 98% of the fentanyl pills that are smuggled into the country are smuggled concealed in vehicles, right? So that's the first Achilles heel. The second Achilles heel is identifying the money laundering apparatuses located in the United States that are assisting in laundering, you know, over $50 billion in narcotic proceeds through Chinese banks back to Mexico.
Okay, we're going to talk about money laundering a bit later. Right now, I guess I'm hearing you say we need to greatly reduce the number of motor vehicles that cross the border every day in order to be effective.
That is a key capability that the cartels are using to beat our mitigating strategies, because every day thousands of cars come across that border. And the cartels know, especially now, this is where the illicit immigration situation comes in with the border. The cartels are monitoring what's happening. They see Customs and Border Protection officers being pulled from checkpoints and put on administrative duties to process the tens of thousands of people coming into the country. That creates a gap in the ability of CBP to check vehicles coming into the country. So the cartels use a technique they call shotgunning. They'll send one car into the checkpoint loaded with fentanyl or another drug, which will be easily identified. That car gets pulled aside and is inspected. Now they'll shotgun another 5 or 10 vehicles through the checkpoints, understanding that CBP does not have the personnel to inspect those vehicles. Now another 10 vehicles just got into the country. Right? We understand that technique. So we would need to put into play a new strategy that I would say puts a cap on how many cars can come into the country every day from Mexico at each checkpoint. And that number has to be one that can be effectively inspected 100%. In my opinion, that would reduce cartel capabilities to smuggle across the border by more than 90%.
That is Michael Brown. He's Global Director of Counter Narcotics Technology at Rigaku Analytical Devices and was with DEA most of his career. Join us after the break where we talk more on the war on narcotics. Hi, this is Kyle Bauer with Plain Talk with the third segment of On the Front Porch. I get to visit with Michael Brown today. He's Global Director of Counter Narcotics Technology with Rigaku Analytical Devices, but he's a former senior DEA agent, and it has really helped me understand the problem with enforcing our drug laws. Thank you very much for being with us, Michael.
So, my pleasure. Thank you.
In the last segment, you alluded to money laundering and getting one of the critical steps was to get the money after they get it from the consumer in the United States back out of the country to somebody else. Can you explain that process and money laundering in general, just so we can kind of get a feel for what it's like to have that much cash?
So let's explain, you know, why is money laundering important? For example, if you were walking down a trail this morning and you found a suitcase with $1 million in it, you might think you hit the jackpot, you're going to go buy a big house and a big car, but the very next day you're going to be visited by the IRS because you have more cash than you can explain, right? You don't have a system which justifies you having that much money. So really all you found is a suitcase full of money that you can use for gas and perhaps shopping for food, right? Because you can't declare it. You can't use it. So what the cartels have to do, they have to figure out a way to launder, to clean millions of dollars so that they can use it, so they can go out and buy things with it. And the way that works, I'll give you an example. It's called NERA remittances. So let's say, for example, the cartels bring some fentanyl into New York City, they sell it, and they make $100,000. Now, the cartels are working with Chinese money laundering organizations. Now, the Chinese criminal groups that do this are doing it for all criminal groups. They are the premier money launderers in the world, and it's for the reasons that I will explain. So you sell your fentanyl in New York City, you make $100,000. Now you have to clean that money. Now I'm going to call my Chinese associate, and I'm going to give him that $100,000. What he is going to do, he's going to break that money up into various allotments, and he's going to give it to various Chinese businesses in New York City, maybe a dry cleaners, a restaurant, or a hotel. Those businesses will merge that money in with their own money and then transfer it back to their accounts in China. Once that money hits the banking community in China, they will then simply wire it to an identified account in Mexico where the cartels can go in, pick up their money, and then use it as they will. That's called a mere remittance. And the Chinese have these connections, tens of thousands of business connections throughout the United States is how they're laundering the bulk of this cash. They also have crypto, right? Cryptocurrency. We hear a lot about crypto. And that's a more sophisticated way to launder your money. Again, you would collect that $100,000 from your drug sales, and you would give it to a money launderer who would then put it into cryptocurrency. Now that money becomes almost invisible. And that cryptocurrency broker can move it all around the world to various accounts until it's clean, and then deposit it into the cartel cryptocurrency account, and where the cartel member can go in anywhere in the world, and he can pull that money out and cash it. So that's the critical capability that the cartels must have, because again, the end result of drug trafficking is to make money. And if I'm making money, I need to clean it, and I need to get it so I can use it to buy more than gas.
You know, when I walk through, I'll pick on Chinatown, and I see all these little shops or any part of the city. I see a shop, and it's like, really? You can earn a living doing that? You know, you don't see many people going in and that sort of thing. I came to realize a few years ago that there doesn't have to be hardly anybody coming in the door, and they might literally be grossing $10,000 a day because they have this money they deposit in the bank, and they just put it as a sale. They're selling this much of whatever service they have, and so it's taxable income to that little shop. But then it becomes, if you will, income right out in front of everybody.
Well, it's a cash business, right? So there's no receipt. So if you walk into a barbershop, you pay cash.
Right.
You walk into a small restaurant, you pay cash. With cash, there's no trail. If you use a credit card, I can track and I can monitor your business comings and going. But if I just walk in and give you $10,000 in cash and you write that off as your daily profit and submit it into your bank, no one's going to question that. It's really invisible money. So if you're a Chinese money launderer and you have a relationship with 30 or 40 cash businesses or large hotels or large businesses where you can move cash in discreetly, then once it's in the system, you can't track it. You can move it all around the world. But primarily, they're going to move it to those Chinese business accounts because they're protected. And then from China, that money can be wired anywhere in the world, and now it's been laundered. It's been clean and ready for use.
You know, I've often thought as I looked at casinos, well, it actually occurred to me 35 years ago when I was in Las Vegas, I stood in front of an area where they were playing blackjack, and there must have been 25-year-old guys playing blackjack for $1,000 a hand. And it was like,
Right. Where
do these guys make this kind of money, and why would they want to spend it? And then somebody kind of tipped me. It's like, none of them, it's their money. They're just there to launder money, and they're paid by the hour to sit there. And after a while, then they take whatever money they have left, and then they go cash that out. Well, then it's clean money, if you will.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I'm watching a Netflix series called Ozark, and that's exactly what the main characters did in this series. They opened up a riverboat casino, right? And then to launder the cartel's money, they would hire 10 or 15 people and give each one of them $10,000 to gamble. So the storyline is you go in and you gamble, you lose $1,000, and then you cash your chips out, and now you give me back that money, and then it's wired back to the cartels. That's a very simple way of laundering money. But, of course, you have to be careful, because if the FBI or IRS sees a casino making too much money, then they're going to start to look at who's actually in there moving that money. But when you look at these large casinos, you know, in Las Vegas and some of the Indian reservations, you have some extremely very high, you know, wealthy high rollers coming in, moving a lot of cash. Who's to say they're not moving $1 million or $2 million for the cartels and getting paid a few hundred thousand dollars to do that? So it becomes a very labor-intensive way to move money, as opposed to the mere remittances where I can simply give $10,000 to a dry cleaners or $10,000 to a restaurant, and then that money just simply disappears. But I think the cartels are using a variety of different methodologies. They're using casinos. They're using mere remittances. They're using trade-based. Trade-based money laundering is, let's say I have $10,000. I want to go out and I'm going to buy a whole bunch of, iPhones or laptops. And then I'm going to sell the, I'm going to buy a laptop for $1,000. And I'm going to send it to Mexico and I'm going to sell it for $3,000. I'm going to inflate the price so I can launder my money through a trade-based sale. So that also occurs. So there's a variety of ways cartels can clean their money. Because when we're talking about $30, $40 billion a year, that's a lot of cash to clean. But when you look at the number of drug seizures, there's very few that count for that drug money being laundered, which means we're getting beat at the blackjack table by the cartels.
You know, I've understood the cartels are heavy into the tourism industry in Mexico as well for the same reason. When I go to, and I'm not going to list a resort, but when I go to a resort and it costs me, whatever, $2,000, but that is a great way for them to launder money. And that's why around a lot of the resorts, it seems, wow, this seems really safe here. Well, because it's ultimately protected by the cartels.
Well, that used to be the case. Cartels, in some of the estimates I've seen, own about 80% of the tourist industry along the Caribbean. You know, 10 years ago, it was a safe place. But now you have seen cartel shootouts on the beaches of high-end hotels, and that's because of the fentanyl and the drug production. It's become so profitable that you now see inner rivalries between the cartels as they fight for control for a bigger piece of the narcotics profit. So now, you know, me personally, I wouldn't go to Mexico for a vacation because you risk kidnapping, you risk being in the wrong place at the wrong time and getting caught up in a shootout. But also, the cartels are in the pharmacy industry. There was a very extensive research project that was done by a university in the United States that identified that a large number of pharmacies in Mexico were selling fake pills for AIDS and cancer patients. And they were targeting the elderly in America because they know that these medications are very expensive in the U.S. So you have what's called medical tourism, right? Elderly people or people suffering from severe pain disorders would travel to Mexico and then buy these fake pills. And then the research, the analysis, identified that a lot of these pills had methamphetamine or some of them had fentanyl in them, if you can believe that. So the cartels, if it makes profit in Mexico, they're going to have their fingers in all those pots, much like the American Mafia of the 1960s and 1970s. They were into garbage collection, restaurants, construction. They were into everything that made a profit in terms of corporate extortion.
That is Michael Brown. He is a former DEA agent and currently works for the company Rigaku, and they make analytical devices to determine if drugs are actually drugs when law enforcement make arrests. So join us after the break when we go to the final segment of On the Front Porch. Welcome back to On the Front Porch, visiting with Michael Brown. He spent 32 years in the DEA as a special agent and currently works in the in private industry along that same line. Michael, you have seen a worldwide view over your entire career of the drug problem as it's evolved. So if you were the drug czar, do we still have a drug czar?
Yeah, we do. Dr. Gupta is really in charge of the national drug strategy for the United States. So I would consider him current drug czar.
All right. So if you were drug czar and we got all these issues, these five different points of, if you will, contact that we could improve on, what should we be doing?
You know, of course, if I was the drug czar advising the president, the White House, on new mitigation strategies, of course, I would continue to support the harm reduction policies in treating substance abuse, substance addiction, and mental illness. But I would concentrate more on dealing with those two critical capabilities to degrade the cartels. One, I would designate the top five cartels in Mexico as narco-terrorist organizations. So why would you do that? Well, that's going to give me the ability to use a whole-of-government approach, right? Now I can bring in the military and the intelligence community to assist law enforcement in putting together a mitigating strategy that will more effectively degrade the ability of the cartels to smuggle narcotics into the country. And that really means I'll have greater access to intelligence that can tell me the who, the where, and the what, and the how. And with that information, I can mitigate those cross-border crossings, whether at the fixed checkpoints or the clandestine crossings using the coyotes. My second official act would be to redesign the cross-border checkpoints to be utilizing better X-ray technology for large cargo and vehicles, increase canines to identify narcotics, and increase hand Raman spectroscopy devices to identify what narcotics or if there are narcotics coming across. I would also increase CBB personnel at each post. And here's the real issue I think would make a big difference. I would put a limit, a moratorium on how many cars can come across the border that are not vetted commercial vehicles. That meaning, if you work for Ford or you work for a big a company that's been vetted, you get to come in what I would call the TSA clear checklist. You come on in, you do a quick inspection, you go into the United States. But if you're just civilian traffic, I'm going to put a moratorium. I'm going to only let 10,000 vehicles a day come in and 10,000 go back out. That way, I'm going to degrade the ability of those cartels to use those vehicles to smuggle narcotics into the country. I'm going to have a 100% check, and I don't care how long it takes. Because, you know, when you travel on an airline, if it's a busy day at the airport, they don't just push people through. Everybody's got to get checked. Everybody gets X-rayed. There is a zero tolerance for letting people get through without being checked. So I'm going to apply that same policy to the cross-border checkpoints. Nobody gets in unless their vehicles are checked. And if you're driving a vehicle back in from the United States to Mexico, it better be the same vehicle you drove out. Because if it's not, then we're going to start looking at you and those vehicles. And this will also cut down on the amount of weapons being trafficked from the United States into Mexico. I believe there was recently a large investigation which identified a huge weapons trafficking organization here in the United States that was selling weapons to the cartels. So, border mitigation strategy, decrease vehicles coming in with narcotics, decrease vehicles going into Mexico with weapons. Right there with those two strategies, I think I could reduce the amount of narcotics coming in to include methamphetamine, fentanyl, and heroin to more than 98%.
You know, yeah. I think that people who haven't seen, like, the border crossing at, south of San Diego, they yeah. don't understand how big this is. I think it's eight lanes of cars.
Eight lanes, tens of thousands of vehicles coming across every day. The cartels know we're hiding a needle in a haystack, and there's no way you can stop it. So what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to remove a lot of that hay so we can now see the needles. Of course, you know, this is going to affect, you know, cross-border trade, it's going to affect remittances. But here's the thing. We have to make a decision. Are we willing to let another 100,000 Americans die from cartel fentanyl next year, the year after, or are we going to try and save some lives? So now it's a cost-benefits analysis. Do we want more trade and to keep people happy, or do we want to save American lives? Do we want to save the 16-year-old from the fake Adderall? Do we want to save the long-term substance user who's been on narcotics for 15 years and is now suffering from mental illness? Right? These are the critical decisions we have to make. And it's not going to be comfortable, right? You know, when you were young, your mom made you take that medicine. It tasted terrible, but it made you feel better the next day. And I think that's where we are. We're at a critical cross point where we're either going to move forward with successful mitigation efforts or we're just going to put our hands up in the air and let the cartels take over America.
You know, truly, at Tijuana, that's where the place is south of San Diego, you have those tens of thousands of cars, but then you have another 40 or 50,000 people per day. Now, a lot of those folks are Mexicans that come in the United States to work, and they go home. They literally commute back and forth. But I've often thought on those cars, I thought, really? Why do we need 10,000 cars going back and forth every day? Because it's like if you're going to commute, if you're truly a working person that's going to commute, you're not driving a car, because sometimes it can take an hour and a half to get through the driving or the car checkpoint. I just wonder if 90% of those cars are unnecessary, that they wouldn't have to come across at all.
Well, you know, is anybody really looking at, are these people really going to a job? You know, let's have a vetting system. Let's have a process where if you're working in the United States, you're going to have an employer card. Your car is going to have to be registered, and you're going to have to drive the same car every day, right? You can't show up at the checkpoint with three different cars in a week. Well, let's have a vetting process. Okay, Mr. Rodriguez, we know you're going to the supermarket or the Walgreens to work. This is your ID card. Your company has verified you. You're good to go. Let's make it quick. But if you're coming in and I'm just going down the street to pick up some dry cleaning, well, we're going to have to turn your car around. That way, we're going to show the cartels that we're onto the game. And we have a system in place that's going to allow us to identify the good cars versus the drug cars. And if the cartels can't move bulk across the checkpoint, then they can't move the narcotics. There's no way they can send tens of thousands of backpackers carrying fentanyl across the open border. That would be like shooting fish in a barrel. CBP would wrap that up in a day. So if you take away those cross-border checkpoint capabilities, how else are the cartels going to move tons of narcotics into the United States? Can't do it maritime because you have the Coast Guard. Can't do it with clandestine air travel because we've got radar. So if you take away that vehicle transportation mode, you have effectively put a crank, or you've bent that supply chain like bending a hose in the summertime. No more water is going to get through.
So you talked about involving the military, and these folks will be determined to be narco-terrorists. Would that mean that our military would be raiding facilities in Mexico?
Not at all. We've done this before. If you look at the U.S. assistance with the Colombian National Police and Army, when we took down Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel, they were classified as a narco-terrorist organization. And we use military and intelligence assets to degrade that cartel. So what did those assets do? They provided intelligence capabilities to the Colombian National Police and military that allowed them to identify and effectively neutralize those critical capabilities that the Medellin cartel was using. We did the same thing with FARC, right? FARC was a terrorist insurgency organization. Same thing with ACL. I think it was ACL, ALC. Right, so we've been here before. We've done these things. We don't have to put boots on the ground. We don't have to use SEAL teams to hit labs. So I don't want to put American lives at risk, right? We don't want another Afghanistan in Mexico. We don't want to be there for 20 years. We don't want that. But the intelligence capabilities that the military and the intelligence community bring to the table, DEA and law enforcement, we don't have those capabilities, right? So with those strategic capabilities, we'd be able to identify who the precursor chemical brokers are in Mexico. Who are they talking to in China? Which airline express companies are carrying precursor chemicals, right? Because all that has to be transferred in using electronic transformation, right? Cell phones, internet capabilities, telephone apps. All that information is accessible with the right technology and the right agencies assisting, of course, legally, to obtain that information and to degrade not only the precursor chemical supply chain, but to degrade the ability to purchase those narcotics, to identify the money laundering aspects, to identify the cross-border checkpoints, right? We can use asymmetrical intelligence in a way that has never been utilized before to degrade the cartel capability.
That is Michael Brown. He was a DEA agent for 29 years. Has fought the war on drugs his entire career. Thank you, Michael, for being with us on the front porch.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.